Broadcasting to New York City, Los Angeles, Chicago, Sydney, London, and around the world, this is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us here on Trumpet Radio Live. We're at 101.3 KPCG, and we're online at kpcg.fm, live link at thetrumpet.com. Coming up on today's program, some questions that science can't answer, but can they be answered? Chemical weapons are still in Syria, apparently, and being used. That's one of the stories from today. And also Winston Churchill, what he said about a united Europe and how that's gone not as he thought it might. That and more coming up this edition of Trumpet Radio Live.
This is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us here on Trumpet Radio Live. We're at 101.3 KPCG, and we're online at kpcg.fm. We have a live link at thetrumpet.com as well. You can listen on the TuneIn app, variety of places. And if you'd like to follow us on Twitter, please do that, at kpcgfm. Also, you can email us comments at kpcg.fm. Dwight Falk and Abraham Blondeau here today. How you doing?
Pretty good.
Good. Excellent. Good to see you. It's supposed to rain today.
Yeah, that's why I wear my skinny tie.
Oh. what's the thinking behind that?
Well, if I wear skinnier things, I'm less likely to be hit by the raindrops.
Wow, that's a really good way to think about that.
Yeah, it's probably not a scientific way, but it's a good way.
Well, we're going to talk about some things that science can't answer. Maybe that's one of them. I'm not sure. This is interesting, this headline to start off with, a terrible headline in a lot of ways, but they say at least 58 dead in suspected chemical attack in Syria. A hospital reportedly hit. And so they did some statistics there for Fox News, and they said that the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons says that it is examining allegations of at least 8 gas attacks in Syria since the start of 2017. You remember the ships pulling out of Syria, right? The
yes.
deal that Russia negotiated, apparently, with Syria, and there was all those ships leaving. They were going to take all the chemical weapons out of Syria. 8 suspected attacks since 2017.
Yeah, this doesn't give, or this should make us reevaluate our trust in Russia. That they disarmed all the weapons of mass destruction in Syria, specifically chemical weapons. And I think this is just a terrible escalation, especially when Assad has been pretty subdued since Trump has been inaugurated. I think he's just been trying to figure out exactly what the new U.S. administration expects of him and the future of Syria. And I saw an article, I think this morning, where Rex Tillerson said something about Assad, about the future of Syria. And then this happened. And they think that that's a direct correlation where Assad doesn't fear the U.S., so he's doing these attacks. And he definitely doesn't fear the U.S., but I don't think it's Rex Tillerson's fault for that, as it's been well documented.
Yeah, there's a lot of history. You'd have to go back and look at their recent history about, well, the red line that was passed and really nothing happened there. So it really just interesting because sometimes it goes that way where they show you the image of the ship leaving and no more chemical weapons and people kind of move on. But when you stop and look, you say, wait a second, they're still using this stuff. So they're getting it from somewhere. Obviously, didn't get rid of all of it, or if they did, they got more. But why would you ever trust a murderous regime if you're willing to murder your own people? I don't think them saying, "Yep, it's so we got rid of it." I don't think you can trust that.
Yeah, exactly. I think if we talk about the future of Syria, Assad can't be a part of it. I mean, how can you expect a leader like that who's willing to use sarin gas against his own citizens? He's not even attacking military objectives. He's attacking civilians in hospitals. How can you expect him to be a leader that you can frame the future with and expect him to honor any agreement? You can't. And I think what's even more disturbing about all this is that supposedly Syria's weapons were supposed to be gone, their chemical weapons, and their capability to produce them. But that's obviously not the case here. And what's more frightening, I think, is that ISIS still is around. And if they get control of those facilities or those attacks, they might use them on an even greater scale. And so I think just the use of chemical weapons in general is still a very real threat that hasn't been solved there.
It's always terrible footage when you see it, see the attacks. I think there's some pretty infamous footage from years ago. There's pictures of this newest one. It's a really, really horrible situation. So that's one of the headlines today. I'm sure there'll be more about that at thetrumpet.com. You can find out a lot about the history of Syria and what's been going on there at thetrumpet.com. The Trumpet Daily Radio Show today with your host, Stephen Fleury. That's coming up here in a bit on KPCG. And you can get the archives at kpcg.fm and thetrumpet.com as well. Make sure you listen for that program. And also stop and check out thetrumpet.com. Top story today is Egypt's tourism industry suffers another blow. Terrorists again target a vital part of Egypt's economy. That's kind of one of the parts of the story, I guess, of the Arab Spring, is that the Egyptians are worse off now than they were when Mr. Mubarak was in charge. And because of that instability, people that made their money off of tourism are suffering because I don't know that a lot of people want to go to Egypt on a trip at this point in time.
Right. Yeah. I mean, Egypt was the powerhouse of the Middle East through the Cold War. And really wasn't until 80s and then 90s and then with Mubarak's health ailing and then the Arab Spring finally is what really notched Egypt down from being a pretty big regional power player to they still are, but not really. I think Iran is the big power player there, obviously. And I think it's really interesting to look at how the United States, through a series of blunders in foreign policy, has really weakened some of our greatest allies. And that even yesterday, President Trump posted a bunch of pictures with him and Sisi, President Sisi, who visited the White House yesterday. And a lot of people, media, were criticizing him for having an autocratic leader in the White House and shaking his hand but not shaking Merkel's hand. And there might be some criticism in that, but at the same time, Sisi is an ally, and he is the one who stopped the Muslim Brotherhood, who is one of the greatest terrorist groups in the Middle East, from governing one of the most powerful countries in the Middle East. So he's actually a pretty good partner, even if he doesn't share all our values. He's helping us out stopping terrorism over there.
Yeah. So you can read that at thetrumpet.com. Egypt's tourism industry suffers another blow related to that. A few more write-ups. Egypt rejects handover of islands to Saudi Arabia, foreshadowing Iran pivot, and is Egypt about to fall into chaos again? Those are some of the top stories at thetrumpet.com today. Make sure you stop and check that out. A couple weeks ago, Abraham, you went down to the Oklahoma City National Memorial.
Yes.
And did an interview with some of the people down there. It was a really interesting story. We've got that at SoundCloud or kpcg.fm if you want to go back and listen to it. And related to that, this is kind of a neat write-up. This is from the Edmond Outlook, which is a local magazine that gets sent around here, and it's talking about the survivor tree that's down there. Did you see that?
Yes. Yeah, it's a huge tree, very prominently displayed, and actually me and all the IA kids had a group picture underneath the tree.
Well, that's neat. Well, they have a write-up here, which is pretty neat about that. A local fourth grade teacher, Gay Sanders, was looking for a relevant way to teach the required Oklahoma history lesson about the bombing to her students. And she learned that no resources about the tree existed. She said, that planted a seed in my mind that someone needed to write a picture book for kids. And she said that she lives here did live here during the bombing, knows a survivor, and she says, I feel such a connection to that event, so I knew that person should be me. So she's putting this book together. I think it's done already. And it's pretty interesting because that tree has been there for a long time.
Yeah.
It's been there longer than Oklahoma City in terms of like the buildup that you see now. And so she has pictures of it from back when it was there kind of by itself, by a farmhouse, if you can believe that.
Yeah, it's a fascinating story, and it's just, I think, when they designed the museum, it was just a brilliant idea to have a living, something that's actually a living symbol, represent those who are still living from that disaster.
Yeah, that tree, she says, survived tornadoes, drought, ice storms, and of course, if you live in this area, you know all about those, and fires long before the bombing. She says once downtown developed, a parking lot was built right up to the base of the tree. It was the only shade around, so employees arrived early and paid to park under the tree. People ate lunch under its shade. Children from the daycare played hide-and-seek under that tree. And then on April 19th, 1995, the elm was badly burned by the explosion of the bombing. Only a few charred branches stuck out from the trunk, and they very easily could have been chopped down, but they used it for the investigation. And then the next spring rolled around, and it began budding again. It survived. And so it gave kind of a nice symbol of surviving a terrible attack like that. So she's written this book, The Survivor Tree, slated for publication later this year by Roadrunner Press. So that might be kind of a neat book to pick up about that bombing and
yeah.
the tree.
Yeah, absolutely. It's just another great resource to use. And there are lots of great resources about the bombing that are developed locally or just around the country. And being from Canada, I was alive at the time, but I was nowhere around here. So it is just great to, with all these great resources, you can almost step back in the past and get a sense of what actually happened. And not only the disaster, but the how the community came together afterwards. To me, that was just the most impressive part of all of it.
When you see something like a tree, a big old tree, it is interesting to think, well, what happened here? Like, what did this tree witness? What has it seen? Who's
right.
been here? Who's played on this tree? You know, it's a lot of them have hundreds and hundreds of years of history, and they've seen all kinds of things. So it's always interesting to think about that. So that'll be a pretty neat book when it comes out. One other local note here that might be interesting. If you live in the area, and even if you don't, a lot of people visit Oklahoma City. This is about the Oklahoma City Zoo. They have a new feature. When's the last time you've been down to the zoo?
Oh, I'd say 2 years ago. Probably.
Been a while. Yeah, so they have some additions for you. Earlier this month, they say the Oklahoma City Zoo broke ground on an inspirational new effort called Sanctuary Asia, $22 million, 6.6-acre project on the southwest section of the zoo will provide even more space for elephants, expanding their already impressive 4.5-acre habitat to a notable 8 acres of dynamic and varied territory for them to explore and enjoy, making it one of the largest elephant environments for any zoo. This growth builds on the zoo's foundation of fostering even greater welfare to the elephants and opportunities for the 6-member herd to flourish under the expert care of the zoo there. So one of the favorites, I think, when kids go, when I go, I like to see the elephants. And so they've expanded their habitat a little bit. And so that'll be neat to check out if you get down to the zoo, if you haven't been there in a while. It's been a year or two for me, I think. But every once in a while, it's great. One other thing they've added, too, is wallabies.
Oh, yeah.
They haven't been there for 6 years, I guess, and now the wallabies are back, and it's in the children's zoo area. So you can go check out the wallabies.
Yeah, the miniature kangaroos.
Yeah.
My sister, she lives in Australia now, and she was sending us back a bunch of pictures of, you can go into like a wallaby petting zoo and like be with them and that. And it's just amazing. Well, it was an amazing experience for her, but it'd be neat just to be able to see them again. And yeah, the zoo, I was really impressed with the zoo every time I've gone. And my favorite are the gorillas and chimpanzees or right. the orangutans, just because they're just really funny, all the different things they do.
Yeah, they have a good sense of humor. I think they're doing it on purpose. I've seen that too. They like to run up and mess around. If they know they have an audience, they tend to play games with each other and kind of ham it up for the crowd. So they're a lot of fun to watch as well. So that's down there at the Oklahoma City Zoo. If you haven't been down there in a while, they have a feature where you can, I don't know exactly how it works, but you can, I guess, reserve a time where you can be there overnight if you want. I guess it's some sort of a feature. I didn't look into all the details, but I thought that would be kind of neat and terrifying.
Yeah, do you sleep in one of like the exhibits with the animals? And
yep, got to go in with the tigers. That's part of the deal. No, it's they have it set up for like different camps and things like that.
So okay.
That would be pretty neat, actually.
Yeah.
It'd be pretty fun. Except for a lot of times the animals are out at night more. You know, sometimes you go and you say, well, where are the lions? I can't see them. And they're taking a nap or something. You're like, come on now. You couldn't do something for me?
Yeah, usually they're just a mound of fur and flesh because they're sleeping all day. And so they still look impressive even when they're sleeping, but they just look like a mound of flesh.
Yeah, really interesting. This is an odd story here. And it's yesterday, you just made kind of a joke about eating pancakes.
Right.
And pancakes are great. But this is a serious story, though. There's a student, I guess she's a college student. She died from, she choked on, she was having, they were having a, it was a school eating contest for like a, I don't know, fun or whatever the why they were doing it. But it was a pancake eating contest. And I guess that should serve as a warning, I guess, to some extent. I mean, she, how many pancakes can you eat? How quickly can you eat them? And she choked to death.
Wow.
And they had personnel there to try to help her, but it was too late. And so, I mean, the pancakes can be pretty dry, you know.
Yeah.
So it was just a really tragic thing. 20-year-old university student in Connecticut tragically died on Sunday after choking during a pancake eating contest at her school 3 days prior. So it took some time, obviously, for the whole situation to end there. Her name is Caitlin Nelson. She was participating in the Sacred Heart University contest last Thursday night and then just started choking. So I guess you do see eating contests from time to time, but if you're trying to put a lot of food in your mouth too quickly, that's a problem. You tell your kids not to do it, and it's a tragic event, but I just thought, well, that's interesting, and maybe that's a warning. Maybe you'd be more careful in some of those things.
Yeah, that is really sad, especially since it's just done for fun or charity, usually those kinds of things. But yeah, it's terrible that a young person dies like that. I remember ESPN would air eating contests sometimes,
yep.
And I could never watch them more than 5 minutes because it's just, it's obviously not natural. And so when you're doing something like that, it's just, I just can't stomach it.
They do the hot dog one every year, the Nathan's hot dog, and usually it's a really slender guy that wins it. I can't remember where he was from. Seems like China or somewhere over there, and I think his nickname was like the Tsunami or something. They had some kind of name for him, and he was, you know, rail thin, but he would just wolf those things down, and I don't know. I guess you get paid for it. I'm not sure why they would do it, but I guess you win prize money or something.
Yeah, I suppose it's a talent. I guess it might even be an official sport, but yeah, it's just something that probably not good for your body, but also no, I don't think that brings a lot of crowds or viewers because it just makes you feel sick.
Well, you know, and I just thought about in the past thinking about that, that would be just something I wouldn't want to do. I wouldn't feel good, but I never thought about the choking aspect, and that's right. A very real thing. So that sadly happened there. First time I've ever heard of that happening, but I would think it could happen. So that's a kind of a tragic story there. Just an odd one, maybe a little bit of a warning too. Who knows? One of the other things going on in the news, there's a lot of talk about, the situation with President Trump's camp or his being spied upon, I guess. He said he was spied upon. They said no. Now it looks like maybe he was. Back and forth. Well, it's kind of interesting. There was a Time magazine cover, I think it was from last month or so, and the cover said, "Is truth dead?" That's the question that they're people are discussing. Can you find truth anymore, and does it even matter? That's what they're wondering.
That's a good question. I mean, especially with all the fake news coming out and then people accusing each other of fake news and all that, it's and especially with the extremely politicized polarization of people's opinions, it is really hard to find objective truth. And even if someone's credible, I think everyone questions it until it's proven beyond that doubt. So it's a good question, and I think it's hard to find nowadays than it used to be.
It was the April 3rd cover of Time, and it was a takeoff on their iconic 1966 cover, Is God Dead? I don't know. You probably have seen that over the years, and it's just pretty much a black cover with the red lettering. They did the same thing, saying that question, is truth dead? And they said the April 3rd cover story on President Trump's use of the truth provoked a massive response. In the New York Times, Frank Bruni wrote that the president's quote-unquote delusional statements in his interview with Michael Scherer could qualify him as a, quote, poet laureate of the sandbox, which is an interesting expression.
Yeah.
but then the other side, Pamela Troll of Homewood, Alabama, wrote that she believes liberal and conservative media alike share blame for today's problems with truth, for mixing news and opinion. And then there are other people responding on both sides of it, saying they just don't trust people in the media, or I suppose people that would have an opposite thought to them. So it's a more and more of a divided nation in a lot of ways, I think, because no one can agree on what the truth is about anything.
Right. Yeah. I think that's all a spinoff from Nietzsche, the philosopher who wrote that God was dead. I assume that's where they get that from. And Nietzsche's dead, but I guess people are still trying to figure out or answer his question.
Right.
But with truth, it is a great point that they make, just that even if something is truthful, if no one believes it, what's the value of it? And that's, I think, the problem where the media is running to, the, like we've talked about before, is especially news media, where it's somewhat of your, it is your duty to report facts. So the public who elects our leaders, they can have a good base of facts off to make their judgments. And when there isn't that that sure foundation of truth on which to make judgments from, that's kind of throws a wrench into democracy and just makes everything kind of what it is today, where no one believes anyone, and it's just hard to get anything done in the country anymore.
Yeah. A writer to a Time magazine, Michael Knapp from Woodway, Washington, he says, "Is truth dead? ? Only if we all stop trying to speak it." But there's different flavors of that. I mean, you have to go back to a one basic source for truth that everyone can agree on. It used to be the Bible in most Christian countries, I guess, on some level. But now, what's your basic premise for truth? That there's no way you can come to an agreement, because there is no basic premise that people look to anymore.
Right. I think looking at the broader concept of things, when moral relativism became popular, I think that really set into motion what we're seeing today in society, where if each individual person can decide what's right and wrong for themselves, if each individual person can decide what's truth and what's not, now we each have to prove things for ourselves, of course. But if no one believes that there's some overarching principles everyone needs to adhere to, then we get to gridlock, where it doesn't matter what you say, I know I'm right because I decide that I'm right, that sort of thinking. And so I think this is all just a spinoff from moral relativism, and how that's really destroying institutions, because if institutions aren't based on one solid law, one solid system of beliefs, then it can be attacked and dismantled, because everyone has their opinion and everyone's has an equal opinion. So who's right and who's wrong?
Right. You very rarely find somebody who says, "Oh, I'm not right. Everybody else is."
Yeah.
That's a pretty rare thing to have happen. A couple of quick notes here. There's toxic waste sites in the United States, and probably everywhere. And so Time Labs, they mapped out all of the 1,317 so-called Superfund sites, the most toxic locations in the U.S., as tracked by the federal government. And they have a map. You can find it at time.com/toxic map. And they're mostly on the coasts, the middle of America, not quite as many. What state do you think has the most Superfund toxic sites?
I'm going to say Texas.
Nope. New Jersey.
Okay.
114. So wow. That's a lot. If you look at the map for where these toxic waste sites are, it is the like Northeast. It's all over the U.S., but the Northeast is like, covered with them. And then California's got a few, and Texas really not so many. Oklahoma. Oh, you know, a handful, but not. Some states are like solid blue, almost, especially up there in the east, northeast. Those are smaller sized states too. So, 114. So, that's not good news, I don't think. But don't drink the water.
Yeah, that does make sense. I was thinking the Gulf of Mexico. That's where a lot of waste goes into, I guess. But that does make sense. After hearing infamous stories of the Hudson River and all that. I think that's probably a good indication that, especially in New York, New Jersey, and that main waterway, that's probably where they put a lot of things that they can't put anywhere else.
Yeah, so that's not great news there. One other quick little note. They have a number of steps that people should walk daily to keep their hearts healthy. Some people like they have these pedometers, I guess, where you
right.
track your steps. And I'll give you a guess. How many steps should a person take per day to keep their heart healthy?
30,000.
15,000. You're an overachiever.
Yeah. I expected twice as much.
I expected twice as much out of you. That's according to a study of 111 middle-aged Scottish Postal Service workers. in the International Journal of Obesity. Didn't know that magazine existed, but yeah.
Didn't know postal workers walked as much nowadays.
Depends where you are.
Yeah.
Yeah. You see them. I see them walking in town sometimes if you've got a walking route. And then I guess over there they would walk too, apparently. But yeah, a lot of times in rural communities they don't. They obviously have their cars. But yeah, I think that would be actually not be a bad deal to be walking around delivering mail.
Yeah.
If you had a nice route and you weren't being attacked by dogs and, you know, there's going to be cold days and hot days. So, but yeah, that's apparently the one. That's what you need, 15,000. So that's the target if you keep track. I don't keep track of stuff like that. I don't know. It just seems like another thing to think about. But it's not necessarily a bad idea.
Yeah. Well, I think if you have an office job where we're sitting, I mean, we do walk around sometimes, but it's actually not a bad idea just to try to figure how much you walk every day just in your normal routine and see if you can add a little bit to it to get a little more exercise. There's these new smart bit watches now from Nike and other places, and they measure your heartbeat and your has a pedometer in it and all those things, so you can use it for all your health needs.
I think for a while they were giving a few of those out, not the real nice ones, but cheaper models. At like McDonald's, if you bought a certain meal.
I think so.
Which was kind of like, it was kind of funny because they were trying to get on the health trend, but it's a fast food restaurant, which is not healthy by nature. You don't go there for health purposes other than, you know, I guess you'd die quicker if you didn't eat anything.
Yeah.
So I remember them trying to get on board with that, and I thought, well, I don't know. It's kind of an odd thing.
Yeah, I think everyone's trying to rebrand themselves to be healthy, like with Coke and Pepsi, the Coke Zero, and like using the aspartame and different sugars, the healthy sugars, all those things. So everyone's trying to be healthy, but I think everyone knows they're just putting a new wrapper on it. Basically, it's the same thing as before.
Yeah. So, but they do say if you are trying to increase the number of steps, you can do some pretty basic things. Take the stairs, don't take the elevator if you can. Park further away and walk, things like that. A lot of times I park further away at a shopping center just because it's easier.
Yeah.
I just don't want the hassle of trying to squeeze into that really tight space and seeing people, or, you know, when I pull out being in a kind of a tough spot, I'd rather just park far away and just take a walk. Walk on in there. So those things can help you as well. You're listening to Trumper Radio Live here on 101.3 KPCG and online. We're at kpcg.fm. Live link at thetrumpet.com as well. Thanks for joining us here on this Tuesday. Dwight Falk and Abraham Blondeau with you here today. And this is kind of interesting. This is 10 questions. I didn't have all of them, but some of the more interesting ones. 10 questions that science can't answer. They're still searching. They say yet because they think they're on the cusp. And some of them, as you'll see, are interesting. Other ones, they're interesting because the answers are already out there. But if depends on what you believe, though. The first question here, why do we dream? That's one that they don't know, and I don't think really anybody knows. I've never heard a good answer to it other than some people say your brain's trying to, I don't know, filter through stuff or deal with things. I'm not sure, but we all dream, and I don't know why, and neither does science.
Yeah, I remember I took a psychology class, and a lot of prominent thinkers think you can psychoanalyze dreams to where it's trying to tell you something about your past or something you're repressing. I don't believe that because most of the dreams are in alternate realities that I've obviously never experienced that before. I know they're just an odd mixture of stuff that goes on in your mind. So I don't know. I think it's maybe a way to get stress out or just to relax, or I don't know. It's just it's like a free movie every night. And sometimes you're lucky and sometimes you're not.
Sometimes it's a good one. Sometimes it's not. I know people that have the same dream all the time. It's like a continuation.
Right.
That's never really happened to me. Mine are very random, usually. I had a dream last night. I don't know. I think it... Well, you're the psychologist, right? So you can tell me what this
right.
means. Okay,
yeah. So... Just let me cross my legs and get my... Pipe,
okay, so. Yeah. So this is this is the actual dream I had last night. I was in... I guess it was the bathroom in my house, but it wasn't the bathroom in my house. Like, it was a different one, but in my mind, for some reason, it was in my house. And there was they had a really high ceiling, and there was a cord hanging down for like a window shade or something. And I pulled it, and like this shower head came down, and I realized that there was a shower there. But I didn't know it was there, and I lived there for like, you know, 15 years, never realizing there was actually two showers in the bathroom. That's the dream. What does it mean?
To me, I think you're trying to tell yourself you need to remodel your bathroom. I think that's what it means.
Or I need a shower.
Yeah.
one of the two. Yeah. And I was really excited about it. I'm like, wow, look at this. I didn't even know this was here. And I didn't, you wake up and you think, well, whatever. It's Tuesday, time to go to work. So scientists don't know why we dream. Another question that science doesn't know, how many species are on Earth? It's a good one because yesterday we talked about, they thought there was one that was extinct. Now they think it's not. The Tasmanian tiger.
Yes.
And then, of course, they always find new things all the time, or varieties of things. So no idea how many species are on Earth.
Yeah, I think that one's fair to where some things aren't finite. Like, we don't know the end of certain things. So I think that one will probably, I'm sure at some point, once we have a camera covering every square inch of the Earth, we'll know. but I think that level of understanding is a long ways off. So, and I'm fine with not knowing the exact amount, because it's always fun to, when they discover new things.
Yeah, it is for sure. Another question that science can't answer yet, and none of us can, is the universe truly infinite? Does it just keep going? It seems like every few months, there's another story that comes out where they focus one of their telescopes into blackness, and they realize, oh, there's a lot of things there, galaxies and so forth. Nobody has any idea. And it's really weird to think about, because we're very, very much spatially minded, you know, a room, a chair in a room, in a parking lot, et cetera, et cetera. What is space in? What is it in? Is it in something? Or if it's expanding, what is it expanding into? Blows my mind.
Yeah, exactly. I think as being humans, everything has limits, or like a room has walls. The Earth is sphere, so it's has an end. Like, it just, you can keep going around a circle. There's some kind of limitation to its space. Mm-hmm. But the universe, we don't understand really how it works at all. We had to invent dark matter just to try to understand it better, where we don't even know what that is. So we do know an impressive amount about it, but I think that's just something impossible. We'll never know. That's what are we moving inside? How much of the universe can we see? Do we understand all the different kinds of celestial bodies out there, or we just see certain kinds because there are bigger ones or smaller ones out there? It's just you can just keep on going, because when you're dealing in terms of light years, no one lives long enough to be able to figure everything out. So,
yeah. When I was in college, the thought at the time was that the universe was shaped like a horse saddle. You ever hear that?
No, I haven't.
Yeah, that's what they said. And I thought, well, how would you know that? Is it on a horse? So who knows? But I think those are fair. Those are fair questions. We don't really have answers to those. Now, here are some other questions that they're trying to answer, but they can't answer because they're ignoring the Bible, right?
Right.
10 questions that science can't answer yet. How did life begin? Well, God says he made it.
Yeah.
People don't. Some don't believe that, though, so they're searching.
Yeah, if you turn to the first three chapters of the Bible, you can learn how life began on Earth and how our human civilization began. The answers are all there. Mm-hmm. And what's interesting is that people dismiss that as a fable, something that's kind of a nice story Christians and the Jews have to try to explain away this question that they think they didn't have an answer to, so they made up some kind of nice story. But it's definitely not. And when you look at it, it's the only answer that actually makes sense.
Yeah. Another question. Where does consciousness come from? Well, if you believe the Bible, it says, what knows the things of a man except the spirit that's in man? Right? There's a spirit in there.
Right.
There's the example of, there's plenty of examples that you can look at and see some of those things explained in the Bible. Nebuchadnezzar, right?
Yeah.
He lost the spirit. God took it from him, human spirit, and he lived like an animal. Pretty fantastic, right? But that's what it says.
Yeah.
And so they're sitting there pondering this question, but that's the Bible answer to it.
Yeah, what's interesting with Nebuchadnezzar is that you can actually, in the Babylonian annals, it doesn't say anything about him going crazy. Of course it wouldn't, because he's their most famous king, and that would be shameful. But there is a period of years at the end of his life where there's nothing written. And then all of a sudden, at the end, he comes back, and he lives for about a year, then he dies in the annals. Mm-hmm. But there's that blank spot in his history where they can't figure out what happened. But if you look at Daniel, you can actually, it lines up perfectly.
Yeah, it's interesting. Another question science can't answer yet. Are we alone in the universe? Well, they keep looking, and they keep finding Mars and other places where there's no life out there, physical life anyway, in that regard. But they keep looking and keep hoping, and they just hope and hope and hope and really want to find something out there. But then ignore the spirit realm, the angels, evil spirits, God, that type of thing. It's talked about Mystery of the Ages, which is a free book you can get at thetrumpet.com. And another one, the last one here, what happens when you die? That's the big one. People have a lot of thoughts on that. I read a book recently by this one guy, and he was talking about his life and some things, and he talked about, the experiences of his life and his parents dying, and then he talks about, they're looking down and watching him. People believe that. They have a lot of thoughts about it. Bible says that David's dead, King David.
Yeah,
it's graves there. So there's a lot of interesting thoughts on that. But Mystery of the Ages is a great book to get that gives you Bible answers to this. Also, the Herbert W. Armstrong College Bible Correspondence Course. So I thought it was really interesting because these are big, big questions they're spending a lot of brain power on and a lot of money. And yet the answers are in the Bible if people believe it.
Yeah, I think every major philosopher has asked all these questions and tried to come up with an answer. But in fact, the oldest book in the world, one of the oldest books in the world, has all the answers. And it's what's really interesting too is, of course, no man knows after what happens after he dies, except for one, because only one man came back from the dead and was aware of everything that happened. And you can find that account in the Bible. And so, like Hamlet and Shakespeare, he muses on this, and all these other mm-hmm. philosophers do. But the Bible is the only book that's not just philosophy, but it has definite proof of what happens. It actually gives you a case example of what happens after you die in several different places.
Yeah. Well, there's actually a couple of examples. Lazarus. There's a few people that came back from the dead.
Right. But I guess only one person knew what right. happened to them in the meantime,
Christ,
I suppose.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there's been a few examples of that. But again, it's in the Bible. And so that's where the scientific community is like, they want to go a different direction with it, but they don't have any answers. They have some theories, unprovable theories, and some pretty wild ones too, pretty fantastic ones, but no proof yet. There's always those stories in the news where people claim they died and they saw a bright light. And it's always funny because they always say that when they like wake up in a hospital with the bright light shining on their face.
Right, yeah.
Like, well, maybe that's the bright light you were staring at. Who knows?
Yeah. Well, and plus people usually one of the first things they do is check their eyes with a flashlight or something, yeah. At least in the movies. So that could explain it as well.
We're basing this all on movies.
Yeah.
But yeah. So anyway, interesting. Some of the questions that science really does struggle with, and yet a lot of them are answered in the Bible if people believe it. Abraham, you've got interesting right up here. This is something that has been talked about recently in California, even because of the drought, and they were considering whether or not they wanted to start converting seawater, salt water, into drinking water and usable water. And I guess they had some plants there that kind of could do that. Israel's worked on some, but they didn't want to put the money into getting them going. And this is from BBC. Graphene, is that how it's pronounced, I believe?
Yes.
Graphene-based sieve turns seawater into drinking water. So they're doing this in a practical way?
Yeah, this is a really fascinating breakthrough because it could really open the door from turning seawater into drinking water. And that's something we haven't really figured out how to do just because salt particles are so small. It's hard to break them away from water unless you boil water, evaporate water. The salt will stay behind, but that's just a painstaking process, and you lose a lot of the water in the process anyway.
Which is, yeah, it's always so frustrating, to say the least, like if somebody's stranded at sea on water,
yeah.
You're dying of thirst, or you're a coastal community that's going through a drought. There's water as far as the eye can see, but you just can't use it. And so this would really be helpful.
Yeah, because I think 70% of water on Earth is salt water, mm-hmm. if I that stat is true. It's something like that. So most of it is water we can't use for anything besides floating ships on. So this is a really interesting breakthrough. And basically, it's graphene oxide sieves. So it's sieves or filters made out of this graphene oxide. And what this graphene oxide is, basically, it's carbon particles, carbon atoms arranged in a hexagonal lattice. So what that means is, like, it's like a lattice, like right. We see in the garden. It's just a bunch of pieces of wood put in a certain pattern.
Mm-hmm.
That's all what a lattice is in this sense too, is that these carbon atoms are put in the hexagon. So there's six of them. And then those hexagons are put one on top of each other. So it makes a hexagon lattice. And because atoms are so small and the spacing is so small, that this graphene oxide is a great material, has great tensile strength, electrical conductivity. So they're trying to use it for a bunch of things because it's strong, conducts electricity. Its hexagonal shape makes it strong. What they're discovering is that if they can make holes small enough in this graphene oxide filter, it actually does break away the salt from the water. And basically, it's really interesting, but basically what they have to do is poke holes in it that are just as big as a water atom. So water molecule, they have to make the holes exactly that big. And the reason the salt doesn't come through is when salt's in water, it creates this shield of water particles around it. It kind of bonds with the water around it. So the individual water molecules can pass through this little hole, but the salt gets stuck and it can't pass through. And this is the only way they've been able to separate the two materials in some kind of filter.
Hmm.
So it's really interesting, and it has a lot of potential because it can break away the salt on the first go. They don't have to keep filtering over and over again. They can actually stop all the salt on just like one layer of this graphene oxide.
Oh, that's very interesting. So is the salt usable in any way once they separate it, or is that just waste?
I assume they could use it for something. I mean, you could use it to make sea salt for like baking or different things they use salt for.
Yeah, I just wonder too, can they keep pushing the water through it, or can they only push through a certain amount and then you've got to swap out your filter, I would imagine, because all the salt would get stuck on there? Because it's such a small particle, or such a small, you know, area for the water to get through. It'd be interesting to see if like how quickly you could do the process.
Yeah, for this, there, from what I understand about water purification, there are just tons, like hundreds of filters, thousands of filters, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
And each of them are having water pushed through, but it is a slow process because you're talking about it's one molecule at a time.
Right.
But if you have enough of them going with time, it can make a pretty big difference. So I'm not sure what the lifespan is on a single filter. From what I understand about the graphene oxide, it probably would be a pretty good lifetime because it is such a strong material. As long as they can have, I'm sure they have a way to clean out the salt out of the tank it's being filtered in. But it's it sounds like it's, they're still a little ways off from being making it into actual production in different places. But it looks like they've figured out a way how to mass produce graphene oxide, which was the big problem. It's so slow making it that, yeah, if you need 1,000 filters, it's going to take a while to make those, and then you have to install them. Some might be broken, or it can be a long process.
People sitting there poking the individual holes.
Yes, with a it's 1 nanometer wide, which is just as big as a molecule. So just having an instrument that can make a hole that small is just incredible.
Yeah, and then you couldn't make them too close to each other, or you'd make it'd be too big because it'd break, and then it wouldn't work. And obviously, I'm sure they set that up in some sort of mechanized way where they make sure it. And you couldn't have them too close to each other. I guess the stuff would become brittle and it potentially break. So you'd have to figure out all of that. It'd be pretty interesting to get it right. It'd be a great feeling to know, like, hey, this will actually work, and then see if maybe they could use it.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's a very delicate balance of all the different forces involved, but it is really important because fresh water is increasingly becoming a rare resource, and a lot of organizations are scared that it could start wars or different issues as nations try to get rivers and different freshwater sources for themselves, and then they could even exhort other countries. They could take advantage of other countries needing water.
Right.
So for a lot of even poor countries that can't afford or don't have a lot of wells and that kind of thing, this could really open up the door to having enough water where everyone can live comfortably. Nations in Africa who aren't by any rivers, they live in deserts or in impoverished areas, they can produce one of these and pump water to where they need it. So it's just it has a lot of potential for good in the long run.
Are they going to put this someplace to start, like to implement a test somewhere, or do they have any ideas of where they would set this up?
It's based in the UK, all these experiments. I think it's just in a lab at this point in time. But I think by hopefully in about probably 5-10 years, it'll actually be something that they can start building in different places. Because the UN thinks in 2025, that's when the water crisis is going to hit. So they're hoping that by then, this kind of technology is available and countries can start buying it and building it in their countries.
Yeah, so that's kind of the motivation, is that they think there's a water shortage coming and they need to get on it. Well, you know, the company that can get this going and get it patented makes some good money.
Yes.
People need water. It's a resource that you got to have. It's even more valuable than gold or, you know, any of those precious metals. Without that, you can't do anything. So water is essential.
Yeah, well, I think it really is the most essential because we can't cook with it. Three days, people die without water. So it really is the most precious resource on Earth. And I'm sure if these companies go public on the market, the stock market's going to go crazy with people trying to buy shares because these are the companies of the future.
Right. Yeah, really interesting. Read it from the BBC there. Graphene-based sieve turns seawater into drinking water, which is pretty awesome if they can do that. You got a history segment for us here today too, Abraham. You're talking about what Winston Churchill said about a united Europe and how that idea has gone incredibly wrong. And so what did he think about a united Europe and the prospects of that?
Yeah, this is really interesting because he was one of the best thinkers on this subject. He lived through so many years of European history and wrote about it that I think, and he himself is a European, being a British man, that I think he understands the problem better than most people who have been Americans who have tried to solve the problem because he has a European perspective. But he also is a great American ally. So I think for him, he is a good balance of understanding both points of view.
Contrary to a new movie that's
right.
Coming out.
Well, actually, the only reason this came up is because I was researching for an article on the movie, just going through Churchill's own papers on before D-Day and what he actually said and did. And it's sad because that new Churchill movie that misses all the great parts, like when Churchill wanted to go on the beaches of Normandy on the first day with the troops. I mean, that you don't need to make a made-up movie. That's a great script where it is.
Right, yeah.
But anyway, in the course of that, I came across some quotes in his World War II memoirs about the plans for Europe, and most of them came from Tehran, the Tehran Conference, where it was a big meeting between Stalin, Roosevelt, and Churchill, the first of many. And this is where they kind of set the goals for Europe until Yalta, much later in the war. But this is where Churchill really laid out his views and where he started to get a little scared of Stalin, basically where he started to figure out that Stalin was starting to cheat America and Britain and that he was trying to get the strategy to where the Soviets could overrun Eastern Europe and give them absolute control over that without any other countries intervening. And that would set the stage for them not giving those countries back, as we saw. So Churchill was concerned about that, but he was also concerned about what would happen to Germany after. And Churchill's big idea, he wanted to make some kind of world instrument between the United States, Britain, and the Soviet Union, to where they could, like the United Nations, where they could keep world peace. Just between those three great powers, they could combine their powers together and avoid another conflict. even Stalin agreed to this, but obviously he had a different end game that he brilliantly, in it, that was probably Stalin's most brilliant moment, was he was able to really dupe FDR into supporting him against Churchill in his different diplomatic efforts. This is what Churchill said about Germany, and that's Stalin was scared of Germany. He didn't want Germany to be reunited. FDR didn't either. They each had a different idea of what they wanted to do with Germany. And so this is from his World War II memoirs. This is just really interesting to read. Quoting, the supreme question of the treatment to be accorded to Germany by the victors could at this milestone, this is 1944, only be the subject of a preliminary survey of a vast political problem. So they were just starting to look at this. And the president's, so FDR's tentative projects for the partition of Germany into five self-governing states and two territories of vital consequence under the United Nations were, of course, far more acceptable to Marshal Stalin than the proposal which Churchill made for the isolation of Prussia and the constitution of a Danubian confederation or of a South Germany and also a Danubian confederation. So basically, each leader had different ideas on how they wanted to partition Germany. FDR wanted to make it into five separate kingdoms. Churchill wanted to make Prussia separate from the rest of Germany and have just one or two other kingdoms there. So they all wanted to partition Germany. This is what Churchill said. We all deeply feared the might of a united Germany. Prussia had a great history of her own. It would be possible, I thought, to make a stern but honorable peace with her and at the same time to recreate in modern forms what had been in general outlined the Austro-Hungarian Empire, of which Bismarck is supposed to have said, if it did not exist, it would not have been invented. Or it would have been invented. Here would be a great area in which not only peace but friendship might reign at a far earlier date than in any other solution. Thus, a united Europe might be formed in which all the victors and vanquished might find a sure foundation for the life and freedom of all their tormented millions. So basically, Churchill knew he wanted a united Europe where each European country had a voice and they could all work together. But the whole foundation for a European Union was based on Germany being partitioned. FDR, Churchill, and Stalin all agreed on that point. Churchill wanted something like the Austro-Hungarian Empire where Austria and each Prussia, Bavaria, and the nations on the Danube were all separated. So they all, because each of them have their own identity. So what I think what's interesting about this is looking in 60 years of hindsight on the European Union. This is these three men that laid the groundwork on what the European economic community created in the 1950s. And I think we can see that it was based on the premise of Germany not reuniting. And if you remove that premise, the idea of a European Union is terribly wrong because they all knew that Germany would come to dominate it at some point or the other. So I think it's really interesting looking back at what Churchill wrote about it because you can see their main concern was Germany. And we can see that through 60 years of the European Union, we didn't heed his warning or even Stalin's and FDR's warning about that. And that we're starting to see that what they feared is actually coming to pass.
So with current thinkers that are writing and talking about what's going on in Europe, have you run across anybody that's talked about what Churchill, FDR, and Stalin thought and said, you know, we think they're wrong, Germany should be united, and here's why? Or do people just ignore it and just move on as if those ideas are not worth thinking about?
The main thing I find is that they view or they choose more modern figures to base their opinions off of, mainly Reagan and Thatcher. Those are the main two they go back to because that's when it happened with the fall of the Berlin Wall. Or they go back to certain German chancellors like Eisenhower and other people, Schumacher and Eisenhower, the French and the German leaders who created the EEC. That's usually where they stop. That's as far back as they go. They don't really go back to what Churchill, FDR, and Stalin were writing about because I think that's a fatal error because they're the ones who created the post-World War II era. They were the three men who presided over it. Churchill was removed from the process, unfortunately, And I think that Stalin really benefited from that the most when he was voted, Churchill was voted out of office in 1945. But I think that's a big problem because these men, they're the ones who actually dealt with Nazi Germany. Even Stalin, the communist, terrible tyrant, but he did understand Germany was a threat. And I think by ignoring his point of view, we now don't take into account Putin's point of view and how to not upset Russia as well when it comes to Europe. So I think what modern writers do is they ignore this history because Germany dominates the European Union today, and I think it would be highly offensive for anyone to suggest they should be partitioned. And I think it would be a faux pas for modern intellectuals to make some kind of suggestion like that.
Yeah, it's interesting because I think any new way of thinking that's different than those three leaders, I think if you really wanted to establish a new way of thinking, you would have to go back and address what they said. And then if you don't agree with it, disprove it or say, here's why this is wrong. But to just kind of ignore it, that's not a good premise for any new thought on it. Because like you said, they were there, they dealt with the situation, they saw Germany reduced to ashes, and then how do you build it back up again? And so, and in what form do you do it? So if the modern writers aren't going to go back to that basis, I don't think they have much, they don't have much basis for what they think.
Yeah, well, I think too, what the leaders of the European Union and intellectuals today need to remember is that the European Union began on D-Day. If it wasn't for American, British, and Canadian troops, there would be no European Union because those are the armies that liberated Europe, at least the Western half that became the European Union later. So I think that's really the origins of the European Union. That's where you need to start from in order to define the true identity and what truly should be done.
Yeah, really interesting history there. That's all the time we have for today here on Trumpet Radio Live. Make sure you listen for the Trumpet Daily Radio Show and Kia David program coming your way later today. For myself, Dwight Falk, and Abraham Blondeau, have a great rest of your Tuesday. Thanks for spending some time with us. We'll talk to you again tomorrow.
You're listening to Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG.